So on to Brexit. So as you know, Brexit is the UK's vote in a referendum to leave the European Union. And this was established by a quite narrow margin, roughly 52% to roughly 48%. So again, you're already becoming slightly familiar with the process. I have a rubbish polling question for you. So how many of you, if you were if in some parallel universe, you were unfortunate enough to be British, how many of you would vote for Brexit? So the two options are, yes, I would have voted for Brexit. No, I would have voted to stay in the European Union. How many of you would have voted for Brexit? Don't believe you. So how many of you would have voted to stay in the European Union? Okay. That's the answer I get in Japan as well. Even amongst people, regular students who feel free to kind of not be too worried about what I think. Can I ask anybody why? It seems to be like a massive vote in favour. Does anybody have a word as to why they think it was it's a good thing to stay in? Toyota exports 75% and Nissan exports 55%. So the Japanese business model is well, we do this in the UK because the UK is part of the single market. And if the UK is no longer part of the single market, that just puts a bomb underneath our entire sort of business model for engaging in Europe and engaging economically with the UK. Okay, so there's a lot of dissatisfaction from the Japanese one. But let me just briefly talk through a couple of possible Brexit scenarios. So people have talked about a white Brexit, a grey Brexit, a black Brexit, a train crash Brexit, and no Brexit. So let me just briefly explain to you what each of those might be before we talk about the different possibilities. A white Brexit would have been a Norway-style Brexit where the EU remains within the single market but is able to negotiate some minor concessions on immigration. However, on that white Brexit model, the UK would still have had to pay in funds, would still be subject to the rulings of the ICJ, and wouldn't have a say in EU decisions. So, as you might know, Norway is a member of the European Economic Area, and so effectively has a free trade agreement with no political control or legal autonomy from the decisions that are made within that market. This option wouldn't be acceptable to most pro-Brexit voters, and May has tried to rule this out in the short term, but let's see what happens. A black Brexit is where the UK leaves the single market but remains a part of the customs union, similar to Turkey. The UK would not be subject to migration controls. UK is said to view this as a fallback option if it's unable to secure something called a grey Brexit, but it remains highly unlikely that the EU would agree to such a deal. So what the UK wants in the terminology of all of this is a grey Brexit. And according to this, what the UK wants is a separate free trade agreement. It doesn't want to be subject to, it doesn't want to be officially in the single market. Doesn't want to pay funds into the European Union, doesn't want to be subject to the rulings of the European Court of Justice. It wants to leave and negotiate a separate free trade agreement, so step back out and then create a new agreement. But, as some of you might know, the EU doesn't have a very good record in sort of negotiating and concluding free trade agreements terribly quickly. So, there is a fear that this could take up to 10 years. One of the leading British experts on these things estimates that 10 years is a good estimate for how long this could take. As you may know, I don't know how much you know about this, so I'm explaining some quite commonly known things. When the UK decides to leave, it must officially trigger something called Article 50. Once Article 50 of the EU treaty is triggered, there are 2 years in which you can negotiate the exit from the EU, negotiate a divorce payment that the UK has to pay to the EU, and then conclude the deal. After that, then the UK has to negotiate a new free trade deal. So it's estimated that the UK will never manage to leave the EU within 2 years. And it's estimated that a trade deal could take up to 10 years. So we may be talking about 12 years. That's a reasonable sort of time estimate that lots of people are making. Before we have, if we ever do, this situation where the UK has left and has a fully functioning FTA with them. So lots of people feel that this is not a particularly viable option. So a great Brexit is where the UK leaves, negotiates a new FTA, but looks to protect key sectors of the economy on a boutique case-by-case basis. So the UK is trying to get special deals for the city, special deals for manufacturing, car manufacturing in particular. Okay. But all of a sudden this is falling within the normal terms of negotiation. So just as Thailand, I mean, the talks are suspended at the moment, but Thailand, when the talks resume, is engaged in negotiation about a new free trade agreement. That's what the UK is also doing. However, we don't know because we're not in the room with the people who are negotiating the practice unofficially at the moment, but there seem to be signs coming out that it's possible that the city could get a special deal because there's a great deal of mutual vulnerability between the City of London and major European companies. So the city as a whole prefers for there to be no Brexit. Overwhelmingly, they think it's a really dumb idea. But if we're forced to go ahead with this, then basically what the city wants is equal passporting rights. So passporting is the right to deal with the euro and to deal with eurozone currency transactions. Depending on which analyst you look at, between 10 and 20% of the total City of London business is to do with currency transactions involving the euro. So there's a potential 20% loss of revenue for the city if there's a tough deal over the city's equivalence. So the city is potentially vulnerable if the Europeans negotiate hard, but at the same time, there's a lot of bad debt held by European governments and by European companies. So if the Europeans don't give the city a good deal, then the city might be tough about falling in some of its existing debts. It might be tough barrels of loaning new money to European companies. So the whole thing is that because of the Brexit vote, you know, the city would prefer to continue functioning exactly as it is, but if as a result of the Brexit vote, the negotiations between the UK government and the EU go badly, the city will be forced to become very competitive with the European government, will be forced to ask the UK government to become very competitive. But the city is arguably a special case, and there are leaks coming out of meetings that people are talking about a special deal with the city. But even if it is the case that the city does get a special deal, it remains quite difficult to see how other sectors of the economy can get sweetheart deals. There's very little enthusiasm on the continent for giving British motor manufacturing a sweetheart sort of equivalent to free trade deal, for example. That's one of the major things which is holding up the EU-Japan trade negotiations, is that the Spanish, the Italian and the French car manufacturers, the ones that produce medium quality cars, are terrified that Nissan and Toyota will wipe them out if there's a genuinely free market for cars. The Germans are fine, everybody wants to buy BMW and Benz, there's a kind of elite market for those cars, whatever happens. But if you let Nissan and Toyota in with their middle brand cars, then they'll just wipe out in theory the European problems. And that's why, that's one of the reasons why it's taking a long time with Japan and the EU. So, at the same, it also stands to reason, therefore, that the same middle of the road manufacturers are going to be really tough. So the UK wants to kind of have it all, as it were. It wants to leave. It doesn't want to be a member. It wants to control its own migration. It doesn't want to have to pay in to the EU pot. It doesn't want to be subject to the rules of the European Court of Justice. But it does want a free trade agreement on its own terms with sweetheart deals in the sectors that it thinks are the most important. And of course, that's an awful lot to ask. And okay, the UK is a large, impressive economy, it's got a lot of hard power, it's got a lot of soft power, but the EU is also a very big, collective, important economic entity. From the EU's point of view, it's also, politically, it's important that the EU, that the UK, doesn't get a good deal. Yeah. Because if the UK leaves and gets everything it wants, then it has a better deal than some of the countries that are still members of the EU. And so everyone else looks around and says, well, okay, we quite like to leave as well then, but can we have that? And all of a sudden the UK, the EU begins to collapse and becomes significantly weaker. So the senior EU Parliament negotiator has gone on record saying, well look, the political fact of the matter is that the deal that the UK gets in the end, it has to be seen to be worse than being a member. We can't allow it to be the case that the UK leaves the EU and gets a better deal by leaving than it currently has by being a member. That's the beginning of the end of the EU. So the EU has a political imperative to be quite tough with the UK. And the EU is a larger economic actor and able, to some extent, to exert significant pressure on the UK. But to be honest, we're guessing. All of us on the outside guessing, it seems as though some of the people at high levels in the UK government are guessing as well. And we won't know what happens until the negotiations start. But one of the things that, I mean, I'm anti-Brexit, but it's very, very clear that some of the senior people in May's government who are dealing with Brexit don't understand some of the key issues. David Davis is on record early on in the Brexit process. So David Davis is the UK's Minister for Brexit. And he's on record as saying, well look, it's okay, we'll leave the EU, Brexit isn't the problem, we'll leave the EU and the UK can negotiate an FTA with Germany. So can anybody tell me what the problem with that is? David Davis said, we'll leave the EU, and we'll negotiate a free trade agreement with Germany.
Like, do you get any being trade deal in FTA in any country in the Eurozone, because it, like every members of the Eurozone have a what should I say?
Collective.
Like some kind of collective policy deal.
Yeah.
In the Eurozone.
Yeah.
So you cannot deal with Germany. You have to deal with all Europe.
Exactly. Thank you very much. So you know more about Brexit than David Davis, the UK Brexit Minister, did at the start of the process. So the point is that the EU negotiates its trade deals as a single economic actor. You can only negotiate with the EU. You can't negotiate a separate trade deal with France, Germany, or Greece, or Luxembourg. You have to negotiate with the EU. David Davis seemed to imagine that you could negotiate an individual deal with Germany. And that's just a very trivial, silly example, but there are so many levels of technical detail involved in the negotiation of all of these different things. Okay, so that's white, grey and black. So train crash Brexit is basically a train crash Brexit takes place if the negotiations go really badly, as they might well do. They don't go anywhere at all, and we don't get an agreement on the UK leaving the European Union within 2 years. Okay. So the majority of opinion on that is that if the 2 years after Article 50 pass and there is no agreement, then basically the UK has to go over to World Trade Organization trading rules, WTO, and under that regime, there are some massive tariffs, so depending on different sectors. So for example, under WTO, I think it's 12 or 13% tariff on motor vehicles, for example. So the Japanese are really, really worried because Toyota, as I say, exports from the UK more than 70% of its cars into the European market. There is a very good chance that basically it will take more than 2 years for the negotiations to be complete. If that's true, after 2 years we go to WTO rules, Japanese companies have to pay 13% tariff to export their cars from the UK into the EU. So that's just one example of supply chain economics. And so, a very significant number of people are saying, you can't get this deal through in 2 years' time. Okay, so what are you going to do as a result of that? So people have talked about a transition deal, that you can't, that it's not realistic to talk about, okay, we're in and then we leave, that you have to have a phased implementation. So it's one thing to negotiate the final conditions of Britain leaving, but you also need a transition zone where there are temporary trading agreements in place. But then the Europeans have said, well, no, we don't want to do that. And Theresa May, in her famous kind of speech about Brexit, asked for a transition phase. Because clearly the British are, in that sense, they're in a weak negotiating position. Because if that 2 years passes, then Britain goes to WTO trading rules, has to pay far higher tariffs. So again, many people say that the UK has quite a weak negotiating position in all of this. So one thing I should say is that I'd be lying if I was claiming to know what is going to happen in these negotiations. Nobody knows. To be honest, Theresa May doesn't know. Barnier, the lead of the negotiations on the EU side, doesn't know. The UK debate, the UK negotiating team don't know. Okay. Some of the information is being leaked. Some of the information is being put out in public. Some of it may be false. But again, a lot of highly informed people are saying that when they first sit down together to start the negotiations after Article 50 is triggered, the two positions will be so far apart that they'll have to stop talking to each other for a while and go away and formulate new positions to come back to. The kind of things that the UK is likely to ask for is so far out of court that it's not even the basis for starting to have a proper negotiation from the European side. So again, let's see what happens. The UK is slated to trigger the Article 50 sort of mid-late March and from them got this to you. So that's the train crash scenario where there's no agreement after 2 years, there's no transition agreement, and Britain has to go over to WTO rules, which is crippling the UK trade. And then finally, no Brexit. So what is the possibility that Brexit doesn't happen at all? And so this option is not likely, but it's more likely than some people seem to think it is. At the moment, like we had a great question earlier on about sort of the will of the people, and I answered about representative democracy. In the UK, a very substantial majority of elected politicians in the House of Commons and an even higher majority in the House of Lords oppose Brexit. There's a very clear cross-party opposition to it. Everyone, a very clear majority of people think it's a very bad idea. However, at the moment, the politics of this are incredibly hot, and so it's very, very dangerous and difficult for politicians to vote against what's going on. Those of you who are following the situation at all, you might know that there have been legal challenges. As a result of the legal challenge, it was established that it was necessary to have a vote in Parliament so that we could trigger Article 50. So we did have that vote, and politicians voted overwhelmingly to support the triggering. But what happens 2 years down the line, or 3 years, or 4 years down the line, when the negotiations go really badly, there is no trade deal, we might be under tough WTO conditions by then. What happens then if we have a vote on whether or not to accept the terms of Brexit? One of the interesting things in Theresa May's speech, and I was really surprised that she gave a really clear commitment to having a vote in the House of Commons, a yes-no vote on the terms of the Brexit deal. She's very publicly committed to that. I thought she would try to avoid having that for all sorts of different reasons. So at the moment, it's very, very difficult for politicians to kind of oppose the Brexit vote, but the popular right-wing media and publishing pictures of judges and publishing pictures of MPs who voted against Brexit, almost as an incitement to violence against these people, you might argue. So it's a very dangerous, almost sort of semi-authoritarian climate at the moment. But at the same time, in 2 years' time, how would Parliament vote? That's an open question. If the deal is terrible, then it might not be the case that it gets rejected in Parliament. Also, by the time we're having a vote on that, we'll be coming up to the next election. So what will happen is that the politics of agreeing to Brexit or opposing it will become bound up with the next election. And there's a famous saying in the UK that a week is a long time in politics, so 2 or 3 years is potentially a very long time. Further down the line, if there's a terrible deal on the table and the clock is ticking, maybe the UK has to go out to WTO rules and get punished. Maybe under those circumstances, the Commons, the individual MPs get a little braver, they organise, they vote against. This isn't the most likely option, but it's much more likely than some people seem to think it is. And again, nobody knows anything, so let's see what happens. One other thing I should mention is that there's still a couple of legal challenges to go. As I mentioned to you, the conventional wisdom at the moment, the conventional interpretation of Article 50, is that once you've triggered it, you're gone. You can't row back. You can't sort of say, by the way, that thing, we didn't really mean it. Once you trigger it, you're gone. Okay? And so the clock is ticking. If you get to the 2 years with no agreement with the EU, you're gone again onto the WTO trade rules, which are very punishing. That's the conventional interpretation. But if you speak to EU lawyers, that's actually a very kind of hard case. It's not so clear whether that's really true. Some people are arguing that Article 50 is revocable. That means to say you can trigger it, but if at a later date you decide not to leave, you can effectively withdraw the original triggering of Article 50. And there's a legal challenge that's been put through the Irish courts at the moment. It's going quite slowly, but there is every chance that challenge will find its way to the European Court of Justice. and that it might prove to be that actually you can revoke Article 50. Again, if it proves to be the case that you can revoke Article 50, that is also quite important because it raises the possibility, bless you, well, Buddhist or Christian, basically it raises the possibility that after 2 years you could have two voting possibilities. You can vote on whether or not to accept the leaving, or you can vote on whether to revoke the treaty. So you will have, arguably, a really bad deal on the table, and you can vote to support it and leave, or you can vote to oppose it and stay in the European Union. So that also has quite a big impact on what happens. So in 2 years' time, you might, if that happens, you might remember me and say, well, that guy seemed like a bit of an idiot at the time, but it turns out he was right all along. It's more likely than people think that there will be serious problems with getting the final Brexit through in 2 or 3 years' time. And again, to be honest, we're guessing if we think we know what's going to happen with these negotiations. So, I mean, that's a few sort of remarks on Brexit from my point of view. So does anyone have any comments or questions?
It's may not about the Brexit that much, but it's quite parallel to each other. Like, I want to ask about the refugee problems that quite damaged the Eurozone, and it happened to be like the major subject that Britain got out of EU. I want to ask that. Why do UK don't accept the refugee, but how could Germany could accept that much refugee?
Okay, the refugee thing.
Yes.
I mean, because I know that's a really big issue in Thailand as well. It touches upon things that we talk about that are sort of related to the fishing thing as well. Yeah, I mean, there's no question that the control of immigration was a very significant thing in sort of motivating people to vote for Brexit. So that's definitely the case. But I would also argue that it's what you call Sherlock Holmes would call a red herring, that it kind of misses the point a bit, because the UK was not part of Schengen. It already has quite significant restrictions on the number of people that can come into the UK from the EU. Also, Tony Blair, the UK chose to not take some of the restrictions that were available. So when we had the Big Bang enlargement in 2004, there were all sorts of negotiated concessions in there that if you wanted to, you could stop Polish or Eastern European or whatever people coming in for up to 8 years, I think. The UK, for whatever reason, chose not to exercise that right. So arguably, you know, there were already quite substantial permissions to restrict EU migration that the UK government itself didn't use. And so three key points so far. Immigration was a major issue with Brexit. Second, the UK isn't part of Schengen, so it's already sort of got quite considerable restrictions on mobility. There were also, with the Big Bang enlargements in 2004, Britain was able to be much more restrictive about immigration if it had chosen to, didn't. That's why lots of people came in. actually a significant cause, the most significant cause of potential terrorist problems in the UK and overcrowding problems on public services such as health and education. They're caused as a result of inward migration to the UK, but not from the EU. So if you, I know we live in a post-truth environment, but if you actually look at the detailed evidence, you can see that it's, you know, the numbers of EU migrants are not as significant, and it's not responsible for the strain of public services. But EU migrants are more likely to be highly skilled, much more likely to be concentrated in urban areas. Overall, inward economic migrants from the EU add value to the economy rather than taking value away. Some of the areas of the United Kingdom which voted against Brexit and talked about immigration being a major problem are some of the areas of the UK where there are not many migrants. So the people who voted against foreigners are people from different places and different EU interests. I'm trying my best to be impartial about that. But I've also been told by a number of the Thai experts that I've been interviewing that Thai people tend to make a direct linkage between this migration issue with the EU and the issue of giving sort of rights to people in the south of Thailand. So I know that there's a temptation to make that link. In Germany, I mean, Merkel, it was a big hearted thing for her to do, to offer to take in so many people. Politically, I think it might have been a mistake because it means that all of the right-wing newspapers can sort of target her. But equally, it's been coming out again. The misconduct and the sexual harassment by young male inward migrants has been exaggerated. And that's been coming out a bit in the last few days as well. Thanks for the question. any other questions? Yeah. You have to shout. Sorry. The question was, we've got elections coming up in various places in Europe over the next year or so. What happens if the right-wing parties sort of win those elections or are able to influence policy? What are the chances of something like Brexit happening in those countries? How would the domestic politics of those countries change? That's a fair representation of the question. Well, I think firstly, in their different ways, the French and the German political systems have sort of built-in protections against this sort of thing happening. The UK has a pretty dodgy system where you have a first-past-the-post system and the winner gets to basically do whatever they want to do for the next 5 years, and there are actually very few checks on the exercise of that power. One of the good things about the US system is that there are lots of checks and balances, and the courts are beginning to stand up to Trump and put a limit on some of the stranger ideas that he's been coming up with. In the French system, it seems like there's a very good chance that Le Pen will get to the second round, but a very low chance indeed that she can win. We said that about Trump. Nobody said that about Brexit, but it was very obvious from 6 months before the Brexit vote that Brexit was a 50-50 coin toss, that people weren't expecting the Trump vote. But, I mean, Le Pen just has far too far to make up. So even if it turns out that lots of French people secretly support Le Pen, and we're only going to find that out on voting day, the gap is just far too big, even if there's a really big secret French Le Pen factor thing, it's just too big to be overcome. So she'll get to the second round and she won't win. This is on video, of course, so you can, you can come back at me later when she wins. No. Also, there was an interesting debate within France, because I think even if her party did win in some sort of parallel universe scenario, they simply don't have the grassroots support and money and infrastructure to become sort of a major party of government. They're a fringe organisation like UKIP are in the UK. So the impact that they can have is that they can transform the agenda of the other mainstream parties who do stand a chance of winning. So in other words, Fillon has had to, in a way, move towards some of Le Pen's other positions in order to become electable. So Le Pen can't win, but in order, the other people who want to win have to move a little bit towards what some of the things that Le Pen wants to appeal to the Le Pen voters. Okay, so there is a general sort of rightward move in France, which is reflected by Fillon being chosen by his party and by the support for Le Pen. But there's a built-in mechanism where Le Pen won't win. In the German case, again, the whole thing is built so that it's very, very difficult for any one particular party to become dominant, so that all kind of, or most important decision-making has to be a result of coalition politics. So it's normally the case that a third or a fourth party holds the balance of power and that the individual largest party doesn't have enough votes to get through its policies. So the whole political culture of the German system is that the majority party needs friends to get its agenda through. So anything that becomes policy is kind of consensus in the middle. The design of the UK system is more extreme. It's designed so that one party wins big and gets to do what it likes. There's no checks and balances. So in Germany, it's still most likely that Merkel's party will be number one in a coalition, but that her support will be reduced. The second most likely scenario is that there's a grand coalition with the SPD led by Martin Schulz. But Martin Schulz is also a former president of the European Parliament and incredibly centrist. So there's next to no possibility that kind of a right-wing government or a right-wing coalition wins in Germany. The percentage support for those kind of right-wing positions is going up, but again, the German political party system is designed in such a way that the parties in the middle win the most votes and they have to govern together. So the most likely result is Merkel wins with a reduced majority or having to do some serious coalition building. The next most likely scenario is that Schulz proves more popular than we think and that he is the leader of the government, but that also Merkel's party will be a significant coalition player in that new coalition. So in both cases, the short answer is that it's unlikely that a right-wing group will win and gain the right to implement their policy agenda. So that's the fundamental point. And the second bit of your question, I've kind of already addressed that. Even though they can't win power, they've been influential. So the mainstream parties have had to move a little bit to the right, as you look at it, in order to pick up some of the voters who are drifting towards the right on that side. I think the doomsday scenarios about sort of the elections are a little bit exaggerated. In both the cases, I think the most likely scenario is that it'll be okay. I think the real danger for what happens next is the Eurozone. So the whole sort of financing question for Greece and for Italy is coming around again. Some people say that Greece really should leave this time, blah, 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 blah. So in the next 5 or 6 months, we're going to have another intense round of problems managing the Eurozone. I personally see that as much more of an issue. So even if, like in the French and German elections, I mean, ISIS and other people who think the same way as ISIS, will be trying really hard to mount a spectacular terrorist attack in France or Germany before those elections to frighten more people into voting for the right-wing parties. But even if that happens, the systems are stable enough. The political systems are stable enough. That's not the issue. The Eurozone is. Any other questions? You'll be relieved to know that this is a really short answer because they wanted to limit immigration. So they didn't want to be subject to the same quotas and subject to the same mobility rules and openness as the other countries that were part of it. So in a way, you could, as I tried to say earlier in response to that question, we already, the UK had already sort of substantially built in limits, relative limits to the number of EU migrants that it had to accept. So, I mean, from my point of view, that should already have been enough, but it was already an earlier sign of UK Euroscepticism, I suppose. So I've been doing this for quite a few years, so I noticed that some people sort of beginning to form a question, their body has been shifting towards the possible asking of a question, but they're worried about asking it. So I've noticed a couple of people who want to ask a question, but sort of weighing up the costs and benefits of doing that. I think if there are still, I think we still have time for one or two, if there are. Just let us go in the name of God. Okay, so I think that we're done with questions. As I say, if you never want to see me again, that's fine. If you thought it was okay and you have some questions or want more information, send an email. If you really, really hate me and you want to send hate mail, you can also contact me at the following address. But seriously, I mean, anything you're interested in, I'm very, very happy to follow up on. I come to Tuna quite often these days, so I may well be coming to other guest lectures at some point in the future. But I think if I hand back to you, I think that's enough.